Welcome, everyone, to Need to Know. I'm Mona Charon, joined by Jay Nordlinger. We are so delighted that you're with us, and we're also delighted that this podcast is sponsored by Ricochet.com and by The Great Courses. And we'll be talking a little later about both of those. If you are interested, you can go in the meantime to thegreatcourses.com and look at their fantastic offerings. As I say, we'll talk more about those in a little while. I'm also very happy to report that we are joined today by one of the foremost analysts of the Middle East and of U.S. foreign policy writing today. That is Daniel Pipes. He is the president of the Middle East Forum and is one of the wisest writers on these matters, and in fact was acknowledged as such I think it was in the Washington Post or Boston Globe that said that if Pipes's admonitions had been heeded, we might never have had 9/11, which is very true. So welcome, Daniel. Thank you for joining us. And I wonder if we could start by a phrase you used that I thought was just so well stated. You spoke of President Obama's foreign policy, especially regarding the Middle East, as leading us in the direction of, quote, European-style remorseful masochists. So could you expand on that?
Well, thank you, Mona, and thanks for the invitation. I think one of the key differences between the United States and Western Europe is that we have a robust sense of national pride. We are proud to be Americans. We are proud of the role that the United States has had in the world, World War I, World War II, Cold War, and beyond. Europeans, in increasing numbers, especially since about 1980, have been overwhelmed with remorse about their own fascism, racism, imperialism, the guilt of being white, of being European, of being Christian, and so forth. This is not unknown to Americans, but it has until now been a minority position, a university position, you might say. But with Obama, has become the position of the federal government, the administration. This is something new.
By the way, do you think the French are somewhat excluded from this category? It strikes me that the French still think pretty highly of themselves.
Yeah, I think you're right. The French are less prone to this than, say, the Germans or the British. Germans, you can understand. They have some real problems in their history. But the British is really a bit mystifying. They were hardly angels. I mean, many things that the British did wrong, as many things the Americans did wrong. Mm-hmm. But the British accomplishment over the centuries is so extraordinary. I'm an Anglophile. I mean, I admire Britain. And I look at this self-hatred and this sense of remorse, and I'm appalled. I wish they took pride in what they've achieved. It's the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta. I mean, it's such wonderful things, but that's not the way many, many British look at it. And I worry that we're going in that same direction.
Right. Now, what is your sense about the damage? I mean, we can agree, Jay and I totally agree with you about all of what you've said and written, I think it's safe to say. Here's a question, though. How much is the damage that Obama is doing to the American position in the world and to the values that we want to see upheld? How much of the damage do you think is irreversible? Assuming, let us say, that a really strong Republican gets elected in 2016 and maintains control of both houses of Congress, is it too late? I mean, how much of the damage is permanent?
I think so far, actually, no major permanent damage has been done.
Wow, thank you, Dan. That's the best news I've heard all year. Thank you. Wow.
See, I knew it would be good to have Daniel on.
I didn't expect this, frankly. Keep going. Sorry.
there have been a lot of bad decisions, but I don't think any of it was really all that consequential. The Iran deal, if it goes through and if it remains as it is roughly right now, this could do real damage to us. But I would challenge you to say what else has been done what in the past 6 years. Now, it has been a feckless foreign policy. It's been a terrible foreign policy. I've written that the Obama doctrine is snub your friends, coddle your opponents, downgrade U.S. interests, seek consensus, and act unpredictably. I'm no fan of it, but I don't quite see where China, Russia, I don't know, Venezuela, Cuba, where have there been really disastrous steps taken? I don't see them.
What about the...
Iran could be.
What about the facilitation of Iran's position as a hegemonic power in the region with our policy on Syria, on Yemen, Lebanon, and of course the deal that they're so assiduously seeking vis-a-vis nuclear weapons? They're laying down the red carpet for Iran to be the hegemon in the Middle East, and couldn't that be potentially disastrous for us?
Well, take away the nuclear dimension. Let's say that isn't happening. The rest of it, yes, is very worrisome, and the Obama administration has been, I agree with you, facilitating it, and it's a bizarre decision to help the Iranians achieve this kind of power. But I don't see that as irreversible. I don't see that as a fait accompli. I mean, look what happened just a month ago when the Saudis put together a coalition of 10 Sunni states to confront. Now, it hasn't gone that well. They've got many problems. But this suggests to me that the Iranians are overreaching and could be in for some real trouble. They are a minority ethnic group and religious group, and they're riling everybody up in the region. So if you take away the nuclear dimension, I think it can be changed. A more forceful American administration that organizes a pushback against the Iranians could be effective. So I don't see that as a permanent disaster. And what's so striking is that, I understand Obama as being primarily interested in domestic politics. I see him in the legacy of Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson, the fourth Democratic president who seeks to fundamentally alter the relationship of state and society, that is to say, to grow the role of the state and diminish that of society. That's what he's really about. Foreign policy is secondary. But insofar as he is interested in foreign policy, for reasons that escape me, reaching a deal with Iran, bringing Iran in from the cold, is his major foreign policy initiative. It's surprising. It's not a bad idea in itself, and it would be good to have Iran back in the fold of the community of nations, as they put it. But the problem is the execution, which is disastrous, which is, as you pointed out, appeasing them and giving them this royal road to revisionism in the Middle East and beyond. Ayatollah Khomeini, when he came to power in 1979, wanted to spread his revolution, but didn't have the means except verbal. Today they have terrorist cells and allies like the Houthis and Hezbollah, and they are on the march, and we are not standing in their way. Though
on the contrary,
incompetence of this administration is baffling, because on the one hand, we're working with them, say, in Iraq, we're fighting ISIS with the Iranians. But in Yemen, we have placed an aircraft carrier group that potentially could confront and get into a hot battle with the Iranians as they try and resupply the Houthis. So it is a tableau of incompetence and inconsistency. And for someone who experienced the Carter years, this is really... makes that look rather good in comparison.
Well, one of the things that you've been known for, and that I've particularly appreciated about your work over the years, is that you have, while you've sounded the alarm about radical Islam, you have always stressed that while radical Islam is a problem, the problem, that moderate Islam is the answer. And there are some people on our side or roughly on our side of the fence who are convinced that there isn't any such thing as moderate Islam, and that the problem goes, you know, you have to find it, you find it in the Muslim faith, and there's no dealing with these people, etc. So I'd like you to talk about that a little bit now, and especially if you could give us your views about President Sisi of Egypt.
There are three basic positions. One is the left position, the establishment position, that this has nothing to do with Islam. I mean, Obama, Cameron, Hollande, and others have said, for example, that ISIS has nothing to do with Islam. Mm. Preposterous, intellectually indefensible warnings. The real argument is really on the right between the two positions you just delineated. Those who say that Islam has always been the same, there's no change. Symptomatic of that would be Geert Wilders, the Dutch politician, made a film called Fitna, where he cited verses of the Quran and then showed how they're being enacted today. Nothing. The time has no importance. The other point of view is the one that I espouse. I'm a historian. I see change over time. I see in my own career enormous changes having taken place. I see things getting worse and worse, but by implication they can get better. If they can get worse, they can get better. It's not always the same. The insight of the historian is that things change over time. You can't just look at something as an essential, having essential quality and never changing. And so I argue that, and many others do too, that for obvious reasons, that the Muslim world is not doing well. And the Islamist response is saying, well, what we need to do is apply Islamic law as of old. Maybe 2015 now, but we should go back to 1015 and apply those solutions to today. And ISIS is the extraordinary extreme of that argumentation. And we say, no, this is a bad idea. And most Muslims actually don't like this either. And the more experience they have with this idea, the less they like it. So let's work with them, and let's encourage them, and let's encourage the Muslims who seek to accommodate modernity and who are moderate and want to be good neighborly. They do exist. You mentioned Egypt. Egypt is the best example. There were tens of millions on the streets of Egypt 2 years ago against Mohamed Morsi. Let's build on that. That is the future. Mm-hmm. As for Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the president of Egypt, I wish him well. I hope he succeeds. I have real doubts that he has the competence to do so. I think his economics are flawed. I think his war on the Muslim Brotherhood is flawed. And I have my own suspicions, and this is very contentious, that he is himself an Islamist, a very clever, canny Islamist, but nonetheless an Islamist. It's a speculation. None of us really know who he is. We're just taking what bits of evidence we have and reading it one way or another. Others would argue quite the opposite, that not only is he not an Islamist, but he's hardly even a Muslim. So there's a range of opinion about him that's still very unsettled because we lack information.
Mm. Jay?
Well, I have a couple of points to make. One is just an historical aside. And I've got a couple of points I'd like to make about Daniel Pipes. When you were speaking of the British and their attitude on the global stage now, I was reminded of that great phrase coined by J.B. Kelly, the late great Arabist, the preemptive cringe. The Foreign Office engaged has perfected the preemptive cringe. And you see that in U.S. foreign policy too. And I look forward to the end of it, or at least a diminution of it. And about Daniel, he told me a story once. I'd like to repeat it. He can correct me if I'm wrong. I asked him years ago, how did you become a Middle East scholar? And he said he was a student at Harvard and he was doing math, but casting around for something else. And his father was probably the preeminent historian of Russia. So, you know, that was kind of out. Russia was out because there was Richard Pipes. And his roommate was Arthur Waldron, who was doing China studies and is now a foremost China scholar. So what about the Middle East? Did it go something like that, Dan?
Yes, it did. And I wasn't that interested in India. And or Latin America and Africa didn't have much history. So yeah, I ended up in the Middle East.
And here's the other thing, Mona, and I stress this. Dan is very, very much a minority in his field, or holds a minority viewpoint. It's a hostile field to our point of view. And I think in some ways a sick field, as represented by MESA, the Middle East Studies Association. And for Dan to have gutted it out for these many years and told the truth as he sees it, I guess what I'm saying is it hasn't been easy. It's easier to be in the fraternity, to be loved, to be the toast of conferences. Dan has worked in the teeth of terrible opposition, and I'm grateful to him. I'm glad he's doing it. We've always needed it, and especially since 9/11 and what we used to call the War on Terror, we've needed it.
Let me just add to that. Yes, and let me also add that it is a mark of shame about the Academy, definitely not about Daniel Pipes. You know, the here is a PhD from Harvard, who by rights should be a highly respected professor at one of our leading universities. But instead, he has his own independent outfit outside of the Academy because his point of view is not respected and is not welcome. And which is not to say he hasn't done fantastic work on his own. That's a tribute to you, Daniel. But it's to their shame that you are not, you know, the so-and-so chair of the Middle Eastern department at Princeton or Harvard or Yale or Columbia or someplace like that.
Thank you, but it's more dramatic than that. When I do go on the campus, if I give a public talk, I need armed guards.
I bet a lot of your hearers are grateful, whether they tell you or not. I bet they think, gee, that's what I think or have long suspected. I'm glad someone had the nerve to say it.
What was the story you were about to tell? Do you went to your daughter's campus?
When she was a freshman. When she was a freshman, and I gave a talk, and then I went to see her room and meet her friends, and I was surrounded by 11 policemen.
Finally, we agreed
we just have two of them, but my daughter looked at this. It's kind of bizarre, you know. What parent goes to visit a child at a college, a freshman, and surrounded by police? That was my dismal fate.
Well, God
but
bless you.
Thank you so much for the compliments.
Yes.
And thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
I enjoyed it.
Thanks a ton.
Take care.
Goodbye.
Bye. Jay, I'll just say a quick word about, I did not know that Arthur Waldron was his roommate. Arthur Waldron, another great scholar, but I will say on behalf of my son's school that he is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, so hooray for that.
May I just add, having been denied tenure at his original school, Princeton, for saying such unacceptable things as the Korean War began when the North invaded the South.
Oh, for God's sake.
True story.
The world's gone mad.
I'll write about it someday, and so will he. Yep.
Oh, the world is completely crazy, crazy.
But he came back, and he landed. But, you know, Pipes is he's a truth seeker, and he's brave. He must have he's swimming against the tide, and he's doing it for the right reasons. And anyway, we've said it, and I'm repeating myself,
but
it is impressive.
It's an old-fashioned word, integrity. He has total integrity, personal and intellectual, and that is a rare and precious thing.
It's very hard not to run with the herd.
Yes.
Socially, politically, in all sorts of ways. It's really hard to come out from the world and be separate, as the Bible says. It sounds great, and a lot of people want to do it. But I think that precious few do. But anyway, let's get going. This is way too philosophical.